Though he loved the Lord and emulated David's propensity to obey God, he sacrificed and burned incense at the high places. Both these activities are customary in non-Israelite religious practice. In a way, the narrator has just let us know that Solomon was simultaneously a very good and a very bad man. The Bible is full of stories that we all know and love. But how well do we know them? The answer might surprise you. The Bible you thought you knew is going to dive deep into the exquisite details of the biblical stories that make them fascinating and transforming. Certain biblical characters have been traditionally associated with particular parts of Scripture. For example, Moses is closely connected to law. David is all but synonymous with the Psalms. And Solomon is famous for his wisdom, not to mention his conventional association with Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. Of course, each of these characters are known for other things too. But there is a reason why Moses and law, David and the Psalms, and Solomon and wisdom go together. As is always the case, however, textual details make all the difference. In this week's podcast, we will deal with Solomon and his vaunted wisdom. We will see what nuances are required when we pay close attention to the details in Solomon's story, and most especially in the episode where God endows the great king with wisdom. Our main text is 1 Kings 3. When it comes to Solomon's being endowed by God with wisdom, that is a story that almost everyone remembers from Sunday school. In a way, it is a simple story. In a dream, God appears to the new king. Then God asks what Solomon would like as a gift. Solomon asks for wisdom, not wealth, and not status. The Lord gladly grants this request, thus making Solomon the wisest man in the world. Right off the bat, Solomon demonstrates his great wisdom by settling an argument between two women. Both women recently had babies, but one of the babies had died. The dilemma which Solomon faced was that each woman claimed that the surviving baby belonged to her. How could Solomon determine which woman was lying and which one was telling the truth? Cleverly, Solomon ordered that the baby should be cut in half, so that each woman could have half a baby. Of course, the real mother was appalled by this proposal and agreed to give her baby to the other woman. Under no circumstances would the real mother stand by to see her baby killed. When the mother did this, Solomon knew that she was indeed the actual mother. The mother was awarded her baby, and Solomon's reputation as the wisest man in the world grew. In a nutshell, that is basically the story we all learned in Sunday school. As far as it goes, that's not a bad summary. But when one pays attention to the details, there is more to the story than meets the eye. Let's take a look at these details. The episode about Solomon and the two mothers is found in 1 Kings 3, but the chapter does not begin with that incident. Instead, the chapter starts with a stunning statement that Solomon had made a marriage agreement with the Egyptian Pharaoh so that he could marry the daughter of the Egyptian king. That's in verse 1 of chapter 3. This is stunning at several levels. One, it undercuts the Israelite tradition that Israelites were supposed to marry other Israelites. That was not a matter of ethnic purity as much as it was a religious requirement. Foreign marriages often involved having a spouse who was committed to a deity other than the Israelite God. Remember Joshua's famous directive to Israel in Joshua chapter 23, verse 12, when he warned about marrying foreign spouses. 2. Egypt had been the country that had enslaved Israel for the longest time. They were only able to escape after God took drastic measures to get Israel out of Egypt, the house of bondage. That's in the first 11 chapters of the book of Exodus. 3. The so-called law of the king, as found in Deuteronomy 17, verses 14 through 20, cautions any Israelite king from acquiring horses from Egypt. That's in verse 16 of chapter 17 of Deuteronomy. If a king was warned about getting horses from Egypt, surely that stricture would apply even more to Egyptian wives, not to mention a wife related to the Pharaoh. 4. A marriage agreement between states comes after negotiation, diplomacy, preparations, and the like. This is not a matter of love at first sight after meeting someone in a bar or a restaurant, or, for that matter, at a well, which is most likely in biblical stories. This agreement involved premeditation and deliberation. Solomon had to have known that marrying an Egyptian princess was ill-advised from a number of perspectives. In any case, this is the first thing we are told once Solomon had established his kingdom. However we characterize Solomon's decision to marry the Pharaoh's daughter, one would be hard-pressed to call it wise. By the end of Solomon's reign, he had married hundreds of foreign women and adopted the many gods to whom they were devoted. This led to God's judgment and the splitting of the kingdom into two. That's in chapters 11 and 12 of 1 Kings. Solomon's initial marriage was only a first fateful step. A couple of other details are related at the same time. For example, this was no quiet marriage. Solomon brought his wife into the city of David, that is, Jerusalem, prior to his building his own palace, the temple, and the wall that encircled the city. At least, that datum underscores Solomon's priorities. Equally, at the same time we are informed about this dubious marriage, we learn that people were sacrificing at the high places because the temple was yet to be built. Quite often, high places are sites where non-Israelite worship takes place. Again, at the very least, this reporting reminds us that Solomon's marriage may have distracted him from other important projects. At this juncture, the narrator does something that is fairly common in the Solomon narrative. Solomon is described in a contradictory manner. In 12:3, we are pleased to see that Solomon loved the Lord and followed his father's footsteps, meaning that generally speaking, he had been obedient to the covenant between God and Israel. That is all to the good. Yet in the same verse, we are confronted with a completely unflattering portrait of the king. Though he loved the Lord and emulated David's propensity to obey God, he sacrificed and burned incense at the high places. Both these activities are customary in non-Israelite religious practice. In a way, the narrator has just let us know that Solomon was simultaneously a very good and a very bad man. Solomon then travels to Gibeon, which is called the Great High Place. When there, the king offers 1,000 burnt offerings. It is not clear whether this is good, neutral, or bad. Regardless, while at Gibeon, God appears to Solomon in a dream and asks the king what he would like for God to give him. That's in verse 5 of chapter 3. Instead of blurting out the first thing that popped into his mind, Solomon gives a thoughtful answer. He begins by noting how God had loved David, his father, primarily because David had been so obedient and righteous. In this response, Solomon expressed his gratitude that God had given David a son to succeed him on the throne. Of course, that son was Solomon himself. That's in verse 6. Once he gives thanks to God for the privilege of following his father as king, Solomon expresses great humility. Though now a king over Israel, Solomon laments that he is but a child, if not chronologically, then in terms of the experience he needs for this important job. Solomon says that he does not know how to go out or come in, a way of saying in Hebrew that this task is too much for him and he needs instruction. That's in verse 7. Pointing out to God, as though God needed to be told, that Solomon finds himself king over a people that God had chosen, and that they are incredibly numerous, just as God had promised so long ago, the king needs something that will equip him for this significant task. Given this situation, Solomon asks God to give him an understanding mind, something that will be crucial in governing Israel. Solomon needs to know how to distinguish between good and evil if he is to be able to govern this great people. That's in verse 9. As you might imagine, God was pleased by this request. That's in verse 10. Because Solomon's request was related to the daunting task of ruling Israel, and because he did not ask for wealth or longevity, God promised to bestow on the king a wise and discerning mind. That's in verse 11. Moreover, Solomon's wisdom would be incomparable. That's in verse 12. For good measure, precisely because Solomon's request had been so selfless, God would, as a bonus, give the king riches and honor. To be sure, Solomon had not asked for these. But God was so impressed with Solomon's answer that the deity thought it was fitting that the monarch end up also with wealth and status. These final gifts were also to be incomparable. That's in verse 13. Just before Solomon woke up, had you forgotten that all this took place in a dream? God had one more thing to say. Solomon could also count on long life, as long as he walked in God's ways and kept the statutes and commandments just as David, his father, had done. That's in verse 14. This was an interesting addition, however, in that wisdom in and of itself was not enough. Wisdom and obedience to the covenant God had made with Israel were both requisite. God's combining bestowing wisdom on Solomon and at the same time reminding him to be obedient to covenant stipulations makes eminent sense. After all, in the previous chapter, Solomon had already used wisdom of a certain kind. That was when David was on his deathbed and wanting Solomon to avenge his enemy. Twice David had referred to Solomon's being a wise man who would know what to do with such enemies. That's in chapter 2 of 1 Kings, verses 6 and 9. That wisdom, or cleverness, was nefarious. Wisdom apart from God and ethical principles is sometimes not only not morally neutral, but possibly evil. If Solomon wants to succeed in God's eyes, he will need to combine his divinely bestowed wisdom with the admonition to be obedient. After waking up, Solomon went to Jerusalem and stood before the Ark of the Lord's Covenant. That's in verse 15. That was a good sign in that it emphasized Solomon's willingness to take the admonition to be obedient to the covenant seriously. Then he concluded the whole process with appropriate offerings and a meal to which all his servants were invited. That's in verse 15 of chapter 3. At this point in the story, two prostitutes appear before King Solomon. That's in verse 16. Wise Solomon is about to hear their case. The first woman pleads her case by telling the king that she and the other prostitute lived in the same house. She gave birth to a baby while her roommate was still there. 3 days later, the other woman, her roommate, delivered her own baby. Unfortunately, according to this first witness, the two women were alone in the house. That's in verses 17 and 18 of chapter 3. The witness went on to allege that her roommate laid on her baby, thus killing it. Not only that, at midnight, this woman who had just lost her baby because of her own carelessness sneaked in and took my baby while I was sleeping. The woman not only took my living baby, but replaced it with her dead baby. So I ended up with a dead baby on my bosom while this woman had my living baby on her bosom. That's in verses 19 and 20 of chapter 3. However, in the morning, I realized that the baby I was about to nurse was not only not my baby, but was dead. That's in verse 21. Upon hearing this testimony, the second woman rebutted the claim by saying, "No, the living child is mine, and the dead child is yours." That's in verse 22. As you would expect, this counter was refuted when the first woman insisted that the dead child is yours and the living child is mine. Then the two testimonies ended. Needing no deliberation, Solomon is immediately ready to issue a verdict. First, he summarizes the two testimonies. Basically, the two women contradict each other's testimonies. Because they were alone, no one can corroborate their versions of the incident. That's in verse 23. That is no problem for Solomon, who asks for a sword to be brought to him. That's in verse 24. Once the sword is brought, Solomon issues orders to cut the living baby in half and then give each woman a half of the baby. That's in verse 25. Once Solomon gave this directive, the mother was aghast. Knowing that her living baby would soon be dead, she was willing to relinquish the child to the other woman as the only way to save the baby's life. That's in verse 26. She felt that she had no choice, for she, quote, yearned for her son, end of quote. The other woman, however, foolishly gave herself away by agreeing right away to Solomon's offer to divide the baby in two. Ludicrously, she readily agreed that this was a good solution, since both women would get an even share of the baby. Somehow it did not dawn on her that a divided baby is a dead baby. Of course, she had fallen for Solomon's trap. Her willingness to go along with Solomon's proposal showed beyond a shadow of a doubt that she was not the real mother. Before anyone has a chance to harm the baby, Solomon demands that it be given to the second woman, since he had correctly inferred that only the real mother would do everything in her power to keep the baby alive, even if that meant allowing an unscrupulous woman to raise it as her own. The case was over. The innocent woman vindicated. The guilty woman discovered. The baby was safe and with his mother. And Solomon's great wisdom had come through. Naturally, all Israel heard about the judgment that Solomon had rendered. That's in verse 28. Indeed, the people were in awe when they saw their king settling this most difficult case. This was hardly ordinary wisdom. This was wisdom that could only have derived from God. Solomon's reputation as possessing incomparable wisdom was now national lore. Does Solomon's display of wisdom force us to rethink the negative assessment of the king at the beginning of the chapter? After all, though his marriage to Pharaoh's daughter was questionable, and his sacrificing on the high places dubious, before long all that is forgotten as we observe Solomon as judge. Besides, God bestowed wisdom on Solomon after these somewhat negative assessments as the chapter begins. God seems not to have been overly concerned about these missteps. In addition, the text continues to praise Solomon for how wise he had become. Solomon was wiser than all the people of the East, whose reputation for having very wise people was legendary. In fact, Solomon's wisdom exceeded very famous sages, Ethan the Ezrahite, Haman, Chalcol, and Darda, the sons of Mahol. No wonder Solomon's wisdom was praised not only in Israel, but elsewhere as well. Equally, Solomon was responsible for 3,000 proverbs and 1,005 songs. Then again, he spoke knowledgeably about trees of every variety, animals, birds, reptiles, and fish. The known world stood in awe of Solomon's wisdom. This is all underscored in 1 Kings chapter 4, verses 29 to 34 in your English Bibles. In the Hebrew Bible, it's chapter 5, verses 9 to 14. Being this wise, this insightful, this intelligent, all because of God's gracious gift, those tiny problems mentioned at the beginning of 1 Kings 3 should be all but forgotten. No one is perfect, after all. And in comparison to his great gifts, we should not make too fine a point about an improper marriage or flirting with ill-advised worship practices. However, were we to continue with the Solomon story, it would not take long to realize that his kingship ended in disaster. That disaster related, of course, to marriages to foreign wives. 1 Kings 3 mentions one such marriage. 1 Kings 11 mentions 1,000 such marriages. Again, this was not a matter of ethnic purity. It had to do with religious practices. Each of these wives worshipped other gods. Solomon, wanting to be a good husband, erected shrines to these many gods and placed them throughout Judah. Ultimately, this led to God's judgment, which came in the form of splitting the Israelite kingdom into two. Keep in mind that when God bestowed wisdom on Solomon, the deity also cautioned him to obey the covenant, something that the king manifestly ignored. In the end, sadly, Solomon became the wisest of fools. Let me encourage you at the end of this podcast to go to my website, faspina.com, and let me know what your email is, because when I get my act together and get these mini courses going, I'll have a way to communicate with you. Also, if you have a question, email me the question at fspina106@gmail.com, and I'll be glad to answer any question that you have. Thank you. I want to thank you so very much for listening to The Bible You Thought You Knew. I have a question for you. Do you have a question or topic that you'd like me to cover on the podcast? If so, all you need to do is head over to Apple Podcasts and do two simple things. One, leave a rating and review telling me what you think of the podcast. Two, in that review, ask anything you want related to the Bible. That's all you have to do. Then, listen in to hear your question answered on a future episode. Join us next time on The Bible You Thought You Knew when we discuss Jesus' personal Bible. God bless.